If you would, please open your Bibles to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie The Truman Show, but in this particular movie, there's a scene of particular interest. Truman is getting up one morning to go to work, and as he is getting his car to go to work, suddenly out of the sky, something falls. You hear the sound of it falling, and then it hits, and hear the smash of it on the ground. It scares Truman. So he turns around, he walks out into the street, and he picks up whatever this thing is he's trying to figure out. It turns out that it's a light, but he looks at it, and he's trying to figure out what it is, and he looks at it. It's even got some writing on it describing exactly which light it is for the camera crew. And then as he finishes looking at it, he then turns and looks up into the sky, trying to figure out where in the world it came from. You see, in this particular show, Truman is about a man who was adopted by a television company. And what they basically did is built a show around his life. And so his whole life is on television for all the world to see, and everybody knows it but Truman. They've built a town, they've made a dome, and in this dome they put a town. And all the people in this town are actors. And everything that happens in this town revolves around Truman. And the whole movie is really about his coming to realize who he is, that he's on television, he's being seen by the world, and making a decision as to what he's going to do about that. I mentioned this particular scene this morning because that light falling from the top of that dome in the sky, for him was his first clue that maybe there was a bigger world out there. His first clue that he was being watched. Now, we're not in a Truman Show, but the reality in life is there needs to come for all of us a reality that there is a bigger world out there. And a reality that we stand in the presence of a great and a mighty God. Not some infallible television producer, or not some folks that are watching in their leisure time on a television screen. But that we live every day before the gaze and in the presence, and under the lights, if you will, of the God who made and knows all that is. I want us today to focus on Psalm 139 as we continue to think of our awesome God. And as we think about this series focusing on the greatness of our God, I don't know if we could find a psalm that encapsulates more succinctly, more profoundly, more beautifully, the greatness and awesomeness of our God than Psalm 139. Psalm 139, it easily divides into four groupings of six verses. As you look at that, it's basically describing the omniscience of God, the omnipresence of God, the omnipotency of God, and then basically David's reaction to that, as this is described as a Psalm of David. But it's describing the allness of God. And as we think about the allness of God, I want us to see that He is all-perceptive. I want us to see that He's all-present. And I want us to see that He is all-powerful. And I hope that it'll be our glimpse into a larger world. And I hope it'll transform or at least challenge us to think about how we live our lives in the presence of a God who knows all and sees all. It was this psalm which was the inspiration for Francis Thompson's poem, The Hound of Heaven. So let's begin by looking at the all-perceptive God in Psalm 139, verses 1 through 6. O Lord, You have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word was on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain it. Now what you're going to find in most of these, it's a little harder to find, in my opinion, in the second six-verse section, but at least in the first, third, and fourth, you're going to find that basically what the psalmist does is he gives a descriptive analysis of God and then a reflective response to that on his own behalf. Okay? So he describes God and then he reflects on what he's described in his own heart and his own mind. So in this first section in verses 1 through 4, what he's doing is describing the all-knowing attributes of God. That God perceives all, that He knows all, that there is absolutely nothing that is hidden from His understanding. Got a couple of interesting words here. The word searching that's found in verse 1, it's the word that can be used for a cross-examination. And you might think of it in a courtroom of a witness that testifies concerning a crime. And then a lawyer will cross-examine and try to draw out the facts and the truth. And he's saying that God cross-examines our lives. He digs deeply into our lives and He knows all about us. The word for scrutinize that's found in verse 3, it is a word that was used for winnowing in the crops, and it's a word that used for separating out the chaff from the kernel as they did their wheat. And the idea is that God separates out the real us. He knows our thought. And He kind of breaks it down into three areas as you look at His description here. He says He knows our thoughts, He knows our actions, and He knows our words. He knows what we're thinking, He knows our way, He says, the path we take, how we live, and how we act. And He says He knows the words that we speak even before we speak them. Again, going back to the idea that God knows our thoughts. And if you think about a human life, what's a human life made up of what we think, what we do, and what we say? And what He's saying is that God intimately knows each and every one of these things about our lives. That there is nothing, absolutely nothing in my life that is hidden from Him. Now I want you to do something right now. I want you to just stop. And I want you to think about what you're thinking. What are you thinking about? Are you thinking, wonder how much longer this will go? Are you thinking, did I turn off the iron? Are you thinking, I wonder if we'll get a seat at our restaurant? Are you thinking, am I ready for my Bible class that's coming up in a few moments? What are we thinking about? And what I want us to do is not only think about what we're thinking, but to realize that whatever we're thinking at any given moment, God knows it. I try to live my life, not just in what I do, in what I think, with that reality. And I don't know about you, that's a struggle to do. Many times we think about our lives in terms of what we do in front of other people. We think in terms of how will it look to somebody else. And we dress for worship and we do everything we do and we come to worship in terms of what are the other people there going to think or say about me. We do the same thing at the office. We do the same thing at school. We do the same thing in recreational activities. We make decisions about what we say and what we do based on what other people will think. And what David says is, I want us to go beyond that. Because there's somebody else that's watching. And there are certain things I can hide from other people. I can convince other people that I am righteous and I am good because they don't see everything I do. They don't hear everything I say, and they don't know what I think, or at least we hope they don't, right? But God knows that. And so that means when I think a hateful thought about somebody, everybody else in the room may think, what a wonderful guy. But God says, what an awful thought. It means when I think an immoral thought about a woman, or if a woman thinks an immoral thought about a man, nobody else may know, but God knows the filth of my mind. He knows every thought that is sparked by the electronic impulses and chemicals and the thinking processes of my brain. And once we come to grips with that, once we live thinking, okay, this thought I'm thinking right now is laid open and bare in heaven. And that right now God is listening to what I'm thinking. Then I think it transforms how we think. And if we transform how we think, it'll transform how we act, and it'll transform what we say. And I want to challenge each of us to realize that every word we say in private and every thought we think in our mind is known to God. And if I do not want God to know it, if it's not something I want God to know about me, then don't think it. If I want God to see goodness and wholesomeness in me, then it's not just about what I say and what I do, but it starts with what I think. Because God knows it all. When the psalmist reflected on this, maybe he has the reaction that I have and that maybe you're having now. This is overwhelming. Listen to what he says. He says, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain it. My thoughts, my mental capacities cannot climb to where you are. Not only do I not know what you know, I can't even fathom the fact that you know what you know." It's like the ant trying to contemplate us as we walk by. It is beyond his ability. And so it is for us. I'm reminded of Paul's words in Romans chapter 11, starting in verse 33. "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and unfathomable are his ways. For who has known the mind of God, or who has become his counselor, or who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? For from him, and through him, and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen." He begins by saying God is all perceptive. There's no thought that I think that God has not first thought and known. The next thing he talks about is the all presence of God. He says, "Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your right hand will lead me," or "your hand will lead me, your right hand will lay hold of me." Now let's stop for a moment and look at this descriptive section. And look at what he's saying about the presence of God. He's saying, first of all, God knows everything. But here he's given me the picture of the fact that God is present everywhere. And I find it fascinating the way he describes it. He says, "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence?" The word presence there literally says, from your face. Where can I go that your face does not look upon me? Where can I go that you're not at? And he's going to describe the height and the depth of it. He's going to describe it from east to west, and he's going to describe it from darkness to light. He says, if I ascend to heaven, you're there. He said, if I make my bed in Sheol, if I ascend to the realm of the dead, the word Hades is the word used for this realm in the New Testament, Sheol in the Old Testament. He said, if I go to the realm of the dead, you are there. I am reminded of Acts chapter 2 where it says that Jesus, after his death on the cross, went into the Hadean realm. I'm reminded of Paul, who in the Philippian letter in chapter 1 says, "As I think about whether I will die or live, depending on what the emperor decides as this imprisonment proceeds," he says, "I can't decide what I want more. If I live, it's an opportunity to help you and to help your faith to grow." He says, "But if I die, it's better." Why, Paul? Because I'm going to be with the Lord. And he's describing what's going to happen when he goes into the Hadean realm, Sheol. And so what the psalmist said, if I go to the heights of heaven, you're there. If I go into the realm of the dead, you're there. Wherever I may go, I can find you. And then he gives this description. Look at what he says in verse 9. He says, if I take the wings of the dawn. And then he says, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea. I want us to picture him writing this from Israel or Palestine. Okay, the wings of the dawn, the sun is going to take flight for them from the east. And it is going to set for them from their perception to the west where the Mediterranean Sea is. And so what he says is, if I go from the rising to the setting of the sun, if I go from the farthest I can go to the east to the farthest I can go to the west, he says, when I get there, you will be there. If I go as high as I can, if I go as low as I can, if I go as far as I can in any direction, he sees even there you are there. Your hand will be upon me. Your right hand will guide me. It's a picture they used, and I don't have this, no offense to anybody who's left-handed, but they pictured the right hand as a stronger hand and the right eye as a stronger eye. That's why when Jesus preached, he says, if your right eye offends you, pluck it out, or if your right hand offends you, cut it off. What he's saying is, even if it's your dominant, strongest hand, cut it off. Don't let it become between you and God. And so here, as he describes the strength of God, he's saying, wherever I go, your strength is there. Your hand is there either for correction or for guidance. He says, no way I can go that you're not there. And then he says, if I say to the darkness will overwhelm me. He says, the light around me will be as night. He says, even the darkness is not dark to you, and night is as bright as day. Did any of you go out the other night after the snow? And what do you notice when you go out? After you've got a blanket of snow on everything, you don't need a light, do you? I notice at our house, the moon reflects on everything. If you've got a few street lights in your neighborhood, it reflects. You can walk almost anywhere in your neighborhood. And I can remember coming home that night, and it was at dark, after dark, and folks are running around playing all over the place. They're not carrying flashlights. They didn't need flashlights. Because literally with all that snow, it was as if night became day. I think of the military and how they use night vision goggles and infrared to be able to see at night as if it's day. And he says, it's like that for God all the time. He doesn't need to flip a light switch. For He sees it all. In other words, He says, you think about how evil often takes place in the darkness of night. And He says, with God, God sees into that darkness. And so He says, I can go as high as I want. I can go as low as I want. I can go as far as I want from horizon to horizon, from east to west. And He said, I can hide myself in the pitch blackness of night. But even there, I will find God. I'm reminded of Jonah, who ran as far as he could. He took a ship that was going to the farthest destination west that he could find. And Jonah got on that ship so that he could get away from God. I think of David as he fled across the Judean landscape, even going over into Philistia and the region of the Moabs, fleeing from Saul. Or I think about the David who hid his sin with Bathsheba from God. Let me ask you, did they ever go where God wasn't? Was David able to successfully hide his sin? Was Jonah successfully able to get away from God? And as David fled for his life from Saul, was he ever really and truly alone? No, he wasn't. Wherever he went, God was there. I'm reminded, I think yesterday marks the 5-year anniversary of when they caught Saddam Hussein. And this is actually a press release from one of the major networks. And it says, across the Tigris River from his opulent palaces, Saddam Hussein shuttered himself at the bottom of a narrow, dark hole beneath a 2-room mud shack on a sheep farm. He had the world at His fingertips. He had the power and the wealth to do whatever He wanted. But He was reduced to hiding in a hole like a rat. And He was found. There are those who will not be found in this life. But David reminds us that God is there. God sees. And all will be found at the judgment. He then talks about the all-powerful nature of God. He says, "For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret, skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and on your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet not one of them was formed." I want to think about the descriptive section, and then we'll look at the reflective section. But as I think about a world in which we live, in which 500,000 unborn human beings are going to be killed this year, or at least generally are, I find it fascinating that I can look into a poet from a few thousand years ago. And as he's describing the all-powerful nature of God, he says, "You have the power to create life." And this is one of the places in the Bible where we have a reference to the human embryo. He says, "When I was yet unformed, before I had yet taken the form that I am in now, He said, You made me. You knew me. You saw me." In fact, He said, "You knew the days of my life before they were ever made." And down here in the last of verse 16, it says, "The days that were ordained." The word "ordained" there is actually the word "formed." And He says, "The days that were formed," or would be formed in me, the life that would be formed, "You knew it before it was formed." You not only saw it when it was yet unformed, you knew it before it was in any form. You know it all. And so when that doctor goes into a womb to take a life, God sees it. God knows it. God made that child. God knew that child before it ever first came into existence. God touched it before ever yet it looked like it would come to look when it came forth from the womb if it had been given that opportunity. He is describing the all-powerful nature of God. But in the process, He challenges us to think about how we look at and how we treat human life. He uses the analogy here of a weaver or an embroiderer. And some of you are tremendous at making things. I'm not a crafty person. I'm not talented and gifted in those areas, but a lot of you are. And what he's saying is, God has made a masterpiece of the human being. It's not any human's work. It's God's work. And so as he reflected on that, he says, "How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you." He stands in awe of a God who has the wisdom and the power to make a human life. And it's fascinating, the play on words here, because what he said earlier is, "You know all of my thoughts." Now he says here, "I treasure your thoughts. I treasure your power. I treasure your wisdom. I treasure your understanding." He says, "If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand." And I'm reminded of Genesis 22 in verse 17, where he uses that same analogy to describe the descendants of Abraham. Your descendants shall be unnumbered as the sand on the seashore. I want us to see how consistently in the Psalms, the psalmist will just stop and stand in awe of God. And what he does is he not only describes the power of God to create life, to begin life, he describes the power of God to end life. So he pauses to praise God's greatness, and then he says in verse 19, "Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed. For they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do not I hate those who hate you, O Lord, and do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies." And so what he says, you are the God of life and death. And so I ask you to bring your judgment down upon those who are your enemies. And I want you to picture this. First of all, as we read this, it is hard for us to take it. It's hard for us to read it because we think of it in terms of the Word of Jesus. When Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And we're reminded of the vision of grace and kindness that God gives to His people through Jesus Christ in the New Testament. But lest we casually cast aside what David says in light of what Jesus would tell us, I want us to be reminded that the Psalms display the raw and real human emotions of a real human being. And I also want us to remember that if David did this psalm, then he is writing as a king. And I want us to realize that his enemies are not just somebody who punched us on the playground, or somebody who hurt our feelings over the lunch table at the plant. It's not even just somebody who stole a few feet from our property line in a dispute over land. As a king, he's talking about foreign nations who rise up against God's people, whose will is to annihilate God's people, to destroy Jerusalem, to bring down the walls of the city, to leave the women and children dead in the streets. His enemies are the Philistine armies and the other armies that would overwhelm the people of God. Armies that are led by rulers who worship statues made of stone and wood. Rulers who blaspheme God, who mock the God of Israel. And so I want us to remember that he's speaking against a more vicious foe than the average enemy we face. And I want us to realize that his point in all of this is not about David. He doesn't say, Lord, rise up against my enemies. I hate them because they did something to hurt my feelings. He says, Lord, there are people out there who are blaspheming your good name. There are people that are trying to destroy the good that you're doing in the world. They do not honor you. They dishonor you. They have devoted their lives to be against you and all that is good and all that your people stand for. And he says, if you go back to some of the ancient peace treaties, they had a common refrain in that which basically said, your enemies will be my enemies. And when two kings made peace, and they would say in those treaties, and we have actual treaties that actually have this in it that we can read. When they signed the treaty, it meant that if your family and my family signed a treaty and somebody waged war on your family, then they became my enemy and I went to war with your family. And what David is saying is, God, your enemy is my enemy and my enemy is your enemy. We are one. And if there are people out there that hate you and fight against you, then I fight against them. And I ask you in your power to rise up and destroy them. Not for my own good, but for your good name. And having had a pause of praise in verses 17 and 18, he has a pause of prayer in verses 23 and 24. He says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Now I want you to remember how he started the poem. He began by saying, you have searched me and known me. He says, you have cross-examined my life and you know everything about me. So he ends with a prayer addressed to God and he says, God, go on searching. Lord, search me out. Many view this psalm as a declaration of innocence, that it's a king who's being oppressed by enemies who do not respect and fear God. And he's basically saying to God, search out my life. I'm trying to serve you. These enemies are not trying to serve you. So I'm asking you to come to my aid. But the fact is, God already has searched us. God has already cross-examined us. God has already known us. And so we can either live life in denial, or we can open up ourselves and say, Lord, look at my heart, look at my life, and create in me a clean heart. He says in verse 24, and see if there be in any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Lord, search out my heart. And if you see what shouldn't be there, you help me to find the right path. I want us to, each of us, to think about some questions we need to ask ourselves as we reflect upon what David has to say. And the searching God in the searching psalm. First of all, I want us to think about what we've been hiding from God. What is it that we think God doesn't know about? How long have we been running from God? How long have we been putting off becoming a Christian? How long have we been putting off expressing our faith and repentance and confession and baptism? How long have we been committing adultery against our spouse? How long have we been using ungodly language that leads people away from the Lord's church in our workplace? How long have we been late at night watching things on our computer that we shouldn't be watching? How long have we been lying and cheating on our taxes? How long have we been slandering people so that we can get a position that they should have gotten? How long have we been running? How long have we been hiding? And when is it that we're going to realize that we are not running from God, but we end up running to God because God is everywhere we go, and that we hide nothing? Stories told of a wagon train that was going out west. And to their horror, they looked up and they saw a line of smoke off in the distance. The wind was coming from that direction, and so the fire was quickly being blown toward them. They knew of no way. They couldn't turn around and run. The way ahead of them was filled with fire and smoke. And so one of the men shouted, say, over here on the backside of the wind, on the backside of us, so start a fire. And so they started a fire behind them, and the fire burned, and it burned away from them, driven by the wind. And then once the fire had burned and scorched the grass and everything it could in that region, the man said, okay, everybody, let's get all the horses, wagons, everybody over into this burned area. And so they waited there in the burned area as the fire approached. And a little girl got scared and he said, are you sure we won't be burned up? And the leader said, we'll be okay because the fire has already burned here. God's fierce judgment is nothing to fear for the people of God. His scrutiny and cross-examination at the final judgment is not something we're afraid of if we've done what David did. You see, what David did is he said, Lord, search me now. Lord, burn what needs to be burned out of my life. Correct what needs to be corrected. Change and transform what needs to be transformed. So when David stands at the final judgment, he does not burn up in God's wrath and judgment because he's already stood, because he opened his life up to God and he had a penitent attitude. He already stands on scorched earth. And what he will know is love and release. And the final question is, how long have we been living life by our own power? How long have we been trying to get through the struggles we face by our own ability, our own wisdom, and our own strength? Don't just see a God who knows everything about us, but see a God who wants to use His power to help us, who reaches out with His right hand to lift us up. If you're thinking about making a change in your life and you're scared to do it, trust in the power and strength of God. He will help you because He loves you. Would you please come as we stand and sing?